If you'd been pioneering circular economy concepts for nearly 50 years, how would you describe the progress we've made? Welcome to the Circular Economy Podcast. I'm your host, Catherine Wheatman, and I started this podcast to help people discover why circular, regenerative, and fair solutions are better for people, planet, and prosperity. Some people think going circular means swapping a few materials or making things a bit more recyclable. But that's nowhere near enough to create a healthy, resilient, and zero carbon world where we can all thrive. Many organisations are missing the game-changing potential of going circular. The disruptors in this space are using circular strategies to reimagine how to create value for all their stakeholders. They're doing better with less. We'll hear from those inspiring people who are challenging business as usual and rethinking how we design, make, and use everything. You'll find the show notes and links at circulareconomypodcast.com, where you can subscribe to podcast updates, my Circular Insights newsletter, and check out my award-winning A Circular Economy Handbook. Hey there, welcome to episode 125. And I'm thrilled to introduce another of my circular economy heroes, Professor Walter Stahl, who's widely acknowledged as one of the founding fathers of what's now known as a circular economy. I first heard Walter speak at a circular economy event in London back in 2015, and then I had the opportunity to work with him on the Strategic Foresight Board for the Circular Economy Alliance. We wrote a paper together on intelligent decentralisation, one of the concepts he introduced in his latest book, The Circular Economy, A User's Guide. Walter describes himself as an architect by training, an industrial analyst by compassion, and a researcher in risk management to earn an exciting living. These days, he's a keynote speaker and author on sustainability and the circular economy, and says he's always been interested in what he doesn't know. Walter is the founder and director of the Product Life Institute in Switzerland, founded in 1982 and now Europe's oldest sustainability-based consultancy and think tank. With over 500 publications since 1975, he holds a number of visiting professor and lecturing roles and has a long list of awards and advisory roles, including being a full member of the Club of Rome. Walter sees the circular economy as a changer of the globalised industrial game, creating societal resilience and providing protection against disruptive events. Walter created the idea of the performance economy as a way of extending the concepts of the circular economy, and says that many of the opportunities are either untapped or criticised by those who benefit from the rentier economy. If you want to know more about the problems of the rentier economy, have a listen back to episode 119 with Ken Webster. Walter summarised his main concepts in Nature magazine a while ago, and I've included a link to that in the show notes. As Walter has been pioneering these concepts for almost 50 years, I was keen to hear how he views things now, where he sees signs of progress, and how we can help accelerate the shift towards circular strategies. We talk about the business case for the circular economy, and Walter highlights some of the aspects that are often missed, especially for the future value of materials. We discuss the opportunities offered by platforms, digital twins, and passports for products and materials, and why we need better ways to assess the remaining life of expensive products and components. We discuss the need to shift from a mindset of owning to using, and the need to change how we frame things for customers and businesses. Walter describes how we might rethink designs to minimise risks and liabilities, and how caring for our things opens up lots of interesting career opportunities, especially for young people. Let's join the conversation with Professor Walter Stahl. So, Walter, welcome to the Circular Economy podcast.
Good afternoon, Catherine.
Yeah, and it's good to see you at a distance across Europe. We've just been talking about our respective winters and emerging into spring, which feels hopeful again. So, talking about hope and where we see hope, I'm interested to know, when you look back at the last couple of years, where you're seeing signs of progress in the circular economy.
Well, country-wise, it's India and Africa that have entered the circular economy market and thinking. The Indian researchers also work now in Tajikistan and all these new countries, so they are actually spreading, not from Europe, but from China and India. In country-wise, the only country that has really realized that the circular economy, especially remanufacturing, has a strategic importance, especially in times of war. It's the assets, stock of objects as assets available in the country. It's only that the stock of objects you have is People's Republic of China for the last 15 years. Then on the corporate side, there is a list that gets longer every day with companies that are moving away from mining or materials, even traders, manufacturers, towards either use or post-use. And just to give you an idea, Holcim, Tata Steel, ABB, Glencore, that all the lift elevator manufacturers, Saint-Gobain, ABB, Vestas, Panalpina, Apple, Samsung, McKinsey, just acquired Material Economics. So a lot of the big boys and most of the consultants are joining, trying to make money in the circular economy, not only for the benefit of the people and the environment, but mainly for their personal benefit, which is fine as long as they behave themselves.
And in terms of behaving themselves, as you put it, and I guess when I talk about it, I'm contrasting strategic approaches to the circular economy compared to tactical approaches, maybe focusing on a hero material or the fact that they've made something more recyclable. When you read about those companies that you mentioned, are you seeing them really putting the circular economy at the heart of their strategies, or are you seeing it used more as a way to improve their resource efficiency, to reduce costs, that kind of thing?
No, I think they are really serious. For example, Vestas, the leading windmill manufacturer, has now started a research program with a Danish university to develop a method, technology to depolymerize the windmills, getting back the carbon fibers and the plastics. Or Glencore, who is now investing in Spain, to build a factory to de-link lithium batteries, to recover the lithium. And the driver in some of these changes is the procurement costs. Procurement costs are increasing everywhere, and almost every day they have to prove something else. And of course, if you use virgin materials, but if you use existing stocks, such as in the case of Glencore,
Mm-hmm.
then you get a big competitive advantage against the linear people.
Mm.
And I think that is driving also people, companies like Holcim. That is the driving element. Or Apple and Samsung. Apple is now the biggest seller of second-hand smartphones, I think for the same reason, because there's another dirty reason involved. But basically, they have realized they can make more money in the circular economy than in the distribution. I mean, Apple never produced an iPhone. It was all produced by Foxconn. But they start to move away from the low end of mining manufacturing towards the loops in reuse and reuse of objects and materials.
Yeah, so that's really encouraging that so many big companies in a wide range of sectors are starting to think differently about stocks and flows. And I guess, as well as the increasing cost of lots of resources, there's more awareness now of shortages or over demand, let's put it that way, of key materials like lithium and copper and so on, and the fact that certain countries have strategically cornered the market in either the processing or they happen to, you know, have the resources in their lands and can control access. And that, combined with all the succession of global supply chain disruptions that we see, and you know, that I guess that one of the problems I see with that is that companies are looking at each of those disruptions individually. So we're seeing the issues with the Red Sea now, and people are thinking, well, when that's over, our supply chains will be okay. But of course, the root cause of these supply chain disruptions is the proliferation of global, complex, very disparate supply chains. And if you're reliant on multiple tiers of suppliers and resources, virgin resources from all over the place, then it's only a matter of time before something goes wrong with that system.
Well, actually, the Panama Canal has also been more or less closed down, but that is lack of water. So it's interesting to see political upheaval and environmental problems that really convince a lot of companies they should produce locally. And of course, the IRA, Inflation Reduction Act in the US, which I think is nothing more than convincing with subsidies companies to move their production to the US, it will also in the end reduce the globalization aspect.
Yes, and I think more a few more countries are starting to realize the benefits of relocalizing, or at least what's the jargon word, friendshoring, rather than relying on
reshoring.
Yeah, reshoring and friendshoring. So, you know, making sure that your supplies are coming from friendly countries. So, yes. So how do you think progress could be accelerated? How do we get more companies onto the circular economy pathway?
That is the million-dollar question. Because, let's face it, the circular economy, if for companies or people in the linear industrial economy, circular economy is disruptive. So to change, you need a conscious decision. And even if you are taking these conscious decisions, then you still have the problem of stranded capital and technology lock-in. So for example, Germany is now investing 68 billion euros in lithium-ion batteries. I'm convinced they are on the wrong track, because they in a few years they will not be able to compete with the hydrogen fuel cell, but then they will fight to the end because they have to defend their present investments. So the what many of these companies don't realize is the lesson from risk management. The biggest risk is often not to change. And they do not consider that. They look at the risk in changing, but they never look at the risk in not changing.
Yes, that's a really interesting point. And it reminds me of something I've talked about a couple of times on the podcast and written about, Clayton Christensen's book, The Innovator's Dilemma, and he contrasted disruptive innovation, you know, genuinely looking at a completely new way of doing things or a completely new need for something and developing a solution to that, compared to what he called sustaining innovations, which were basically incremental improvements to the thing that you already do. And one of the, he kind of highlighted about five characteristics of companies that are stuck in this incremental improvements mindset. And one of those was that they didn't talk to their non-customers. They only listened to their existing customers and what those people wanted, which of course was always, you know, a bit faster, a bit more efficient, costing a bit less. But those customers weren't the innovators who were looking at, you know, well, we could do this completely different thing. But once that arrived, you know, and he looked at the sort of innovation progression from mainframe computers to micro to, you know, to PCs and laptops and so on. And of course, as soon as, if you'd got a PC, as soon as a laptop came along, you wanted that, but you weren't going to be asking your supplier for that 3 or 4 years earlier because you had no idea such a thing could exist. So this business of talking to your non-customers and really finding out what's at the heart of what people want, rather than focusing on what you already make and sell, I think is something that lots of businesses could do more of.
Several companies like Burckhardt Compression, for example, are moving from manufacture into operation and maintenance. And not only of their own equipment, but offering, for example, this for all the compressors of a client's fleet, compressor fleet. So they slowly put more weight on Rolls-Royce and a number of companies. They have realized that they can do a service for their clients and at the same time get a bigger market share of the stock at clients' places. Then another thing that's interesting is, I don't know if you remember Andrew Hagen's paper License to Mine, that nation states should pay mining companies to find the ore, but then give it to the nation state and not sell them themselves. And the first country that is now has renegotiated a contract in that sense is Botswana with De Beers. It's about diamonds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's not in that sense for critical raw materials, but Botswana is now demanding that half the diamonds that produced by De Beers remain in the country and are polished and sold through the Botswana to be established channels. And many of these things have not really been viewed in the big press because it's people, I don't think journalists realize what's going on. Another thing is re-mining the tailings. Every mine has huge tailings, and Gordon Battelle was the first who made a fortune by with tin mines, simply putting tin mines through a machine that recovered 50% of the tin, and it became 100 years ago one of the richest people in the world. And then founded the Battelle Institute in Columbus, Ohio. But now some mines in South America have found that the most of their tailings are sand in the quality desired by concrete makers.
Mm.
So instead of taking marine sand, which is becoming critical, they now start to re-mine their own tailings. And another example I've just come across is a company that has discovered that by using hydrogen, they can recover, can't remember, aluminum or iron from their tailings. So it's not only urban mining, but it's re-mining your own tailings, which of course also leads to less leakage of heavy metals or whatever into the water, into the rivers. So things on different levels, different sectors. I think the circular economy is being pursued actively by people who are entering the market new because they can make money from something they own and have never used. So I think the money is still the biggest driver in many, many countries, many companies.
Yes, yes, definitely. And I think there are some really interesting innovations around mining and quite, I think it was in episode 60-something, I featured a company called Nth Cycle, NTH, as in the nth degree of something. So Nth Cycle. So they used hydrometallurgy and repurposed a technique that was used for cleaning up sewage, but they repurposed that to program the technology that they used to either remine mining tailings or to recover metals and minerals from e-waste. And it's they've thought about all the pain points for recyclers and for mining companies, including the fact that this equipment needs to be quite small and you know, manageable, because there's no point in asking companies to travel miles and miles and miles to do this. So they've got a really, really interesting solution that can be programmed to do, you know, to do kind of bespoke recovery of whatever's available in the in either the mining tailings or the e-waste. So it's brilliant to see companies, large and small, really focusing on innovating to keep materials in use and kind of intensify the value that you can extract from what you're
several
doing.
Public authorities have started to recover the phosphorus from wastewater streams. And of course, especially in rivers near electronic manufacturing, you can also recover gold and silver from basically wastewater contains a lot of heat. They use heat pumps to recover heat from the hot wastewater. So I think it's happening locally, individually, but the journalists don't, most journalists still haven't understood what the circular economy really is. Recovering, delinking, repair, they start to understand. Remanufacturing, I'm still not sure they know how beneficial it is, but remanufacture starts to be understood by corporations and countries that it has also strategic advantages, as I said before.
Yes, yes, I agree. And I think the European Union is starting to see the potential for its own kind of industrial production and GDP, but also helping to make the European Union more secure and less reliant on overseas products and resources. So we've talked about a few companies that are starting to make the business case for various aspects of the circular economy. Do you think businesses are finding it easy to make the case? And if not, is there anything that you would suggest they should look at or do differently?
Well, the companies that are just within a chain production, for example, people producing forged components for the car industry, they have always maintained that there's nothing they can do, but they can actually recover their components, such as roller. Hang on. Ball bearings, roller bearings, because in a kart, ball bearings, roller bearings are used about 80%. And if the manufacturer could get back these components from the scrap yard, they could very cheaply remanufacture and resell them. They could even produce longer lasting ball bearings by nanotechnology polishing of the balls. But the thing is, there is the link is missing between the car demolisher or dismantler and the component manufacturer. And I think in many cases this it slowly starts that realize that the dismantlers should not put a car into a shredder, but should really dismantle all the bits that can be resold because they get a higher price for it. And I know that some companies in the electromechanical field have now started to have agreements with copper recyclers so that the copper recyclers really get all the copper out of the products or systems they get back for recycling and then exclusively resell the copper to these, I'm not going to tell you the names, to these companies. And that is also a good sign because that the manufacturers start to realize they have to secure their supply to strategic materials. And of course, again, you said before, cornering the market. By that, of course, they corner the market for other manufacturers because at some point they will only find new materials and then they fall into this compliance trap that the new material will be much more expensive than the second-hand resources that the other companies have secured for themselves.
So I guess the lesson for businesses taking that example and thinking for other businesses, it's kind of looking into the future, further than a couple of years, but looking at the long term and thinking about the resources that your products and services depend on, and then thinking about, well, how could we make sure we close the loop on these resources and keep them within our own value chain,
Yeah,
whether that's
it's basically backcasting. You put yourself in the year 2050, and then you look back, what do I need from today? And then you make contracts on this and not on the present problems or shortages.
Yeah, and looking also to see who could you collaborate with, like the vehicle dismantlers and recyclers.
Yes.
And I guess one of the things that will be helpful in those kind of scenarios are things like product and material passports, where it's easier for the recycler to see what kind of things are in this, and if this is a BMW car, then the bearings are made by, I don't know, ABB or whoever. And so that means it's more attractive to me because I know I've got a partnership with that company to get them the bearings back. So all these things could have, we have all the means to do this kind of thing, don't we? We have the platforms, we have the technology, we have the ability to create product and material passports. It just all needs to accelerate.
Yeah, it's the same applies to digital twins, because then the MADAS, the material passports are basically physical twins. But you can also have digital twins, for example, in infrastructure, so that you actually know before you start digging, you know where all the cables and different pipes are running. And of course, you can have material twins. If you think back to the Comet disaster, where they, after first two British jets crashed midair. They put a complete aircraft fuselage into a water tank and simulated things, and then they realized there always cracks at the same place as those cars, but the aircraft had crashed. So you could actually, in the prevent losses, prevent disasters by doing more preventive or foresight testing of things that are in use. And this is would be a completely new field of activity for companies that are looking for innovative ways to extend or make it safer to use used goods.
And I guess as more companies move towards a service-based model, being able to stand behind the durability and safety of your equipment gets more and more critical. And I guess also what you were talking about just there comes back to what you mentioned earlier, that not enough companies are doing proper risk management. They kind of skate over the surface and look for the things that shout out to everybody, but don't really look far enough into the future or at all the things that could go wrong and how those could be prevented and create more value at the same time. It's not just about spending money on risk mitigation, is it? It's about looking at how could we prevent this and make sure that we recover value from it, or that we have our partners benefit or whatever.
Yes, actually, one practical example of this, how to define the quality of a used product, is now happening in Germany, because a lot of the car rental companies have sold all their electric cars, mainly Teslas, and the second-hand car dealers have now realized that they can hardly sell these second-hand cars which they bought, because they cannot give a guarantee how long the lithium-ion batteries, which is the critical thing, will still last. And so people shy away from buying second-hand e-cars, but then the car dealers are stuck with the hundreds of e-cars, which at the end they have to almost give away to get rid of them. And that is something that we could have foreseen, that we, especially with batteries, we need to be able to give a guarantee of to what degree it has already been used or how many more miles you can do with the present batteries. And so this quality control of used goods is basically for all major components has been neglected so far.
Yes, I agree.
Except for steam engines, and there are some elevators, lifts, there are some safety issues where this is done through annual checks, but it's only for safety reasons, whereas with the lithium ion batteries, you'd like to know that the rest use value that you buy, and
Yes.
there's no way to know that.
Yes, you definitely don't want to buy a car and then find out in a week's time that the battery's useless and it's only going to get you 2 or 3 miles down the road before it needs recharging. Or 2 or 3 kilometres, I should say, Walter.
Doesn't matter.
So is there anything else that you see holding businesses back in general?
I can see where we are running into a dead end situation. If you look at, we know that subsidies for fossil fuel production and consumption are more than $5 trillion worldwide. And so logically, we have to reduce these subsidies if we want to fight carbon, if the carbon issue is really the important issue. And you have probably seen in all over Europe now, the farmers have come out and blocking the roads and the airports because the governments wanted to reduce by half the carbon, no, sorry, the diesel subsidies. And in the present situation, with money getting scarce or prices rising, farmers are really near economic suicide. And again, in this complex, or nobody's doing this holistic view to see okay, if we want to reduce fossil fuels, then we must have a cheap alternative. And e-mobility is no good for big tractors or big machines. The software controlled Internet of Things for farm equipment, for example, is another thing that people no longer really control their equipment they have bought. But whenever it breaks down, they have to let somebody come from the manufacturer to repair it. And if you are a farmer in Scotland, that can take 2 or 3 days. So it gets very expensive. So you're actually better off by buying a non-modern 20-year-old John Deere tractor, because then the local blacksmith or mechanic can repair it. So the thing at the moment, progress is always seen positively and by the manufacturer, but the user very often would be better off without the latest technology. So this is actually at the moment pushing the second-hand market for many, many products.
Yes, and there are other issues kind of circling around, particularly with tractors, in that regenerative farming is encouraging farmers to move away from these tractors with enormous tires that compact the soil so much, and to do less, do no ploughing and no tilling and so on. So, maybe in 10 or 20 years' time, tractors will be few and far between because, they're only used for moving a few things around between fields. So it's kind of it comes back to this, looking far into the future and thinking about what the pressures are, and whether the direction that the industry around you seems to be going in is really a long-term future fit direction. So yeah, thank you. So, Walter, is there somebody that you'd like to give a shout out to? Somebody that you see have as a favourite circular economy example when you're telling people what the circular economy is all about?
No, it depends. If I talk to people, individuals, I sell them the circular economy by saying, enjoy the use of your belongings and take good care of them. So we have to change language. We have to put the emphasis on enjoyment, on the use, and caring. Not away from fashion, away from the latest fad, because like the e-cigarettes that have lithium-ion batteries and that most people throw away have now become a major fire risk. Also in aviation, we had two EasyJet aircraft recently that had to return to Geneva because a fire started in the luggage compartment. So the many of the old products were actually as good and much safer. But to companies, it's really the argument that you want to put yourself in a position where you can still be in 20 or 30 years. And that is in the use phase and much less in the manufacturing phase or in the mining phase. So think about like Burckhardt compressors, think about how you can displace your main activity into services, operation maintenance, or selling objects as a service. But then of course you have to include that you become responsible for the cost of risk and waste and liability. So you will have to design your products differently, and you have to protect yourself against misuse, abuse by users.
Yes. So I guess servitization on the face of it sounds straightforward, but there's lots to think about. And in a recent podcast, with Ian McKechnie from the Advanced Services Group at Warwick University in the UK. So they're helping companies to move along what they call the services staircase. So it might, you might start off by selling consumables to go with the product that you offer, and then you kind of move all the way up the rungs of the staircase, the rungs of the ladder, to the point where you're selling the performance of the object. But you don't necessarily have to kind of leap in to the whole thing to begin with. So yeah, that's good. And Walter, if you could wave a magic wand and change one thing tomorrow to help create a better world, what would that be and why?
I think that is an illusion, because between the different continents and countries, there are cultural issues. Some people are already in a performance economy. Other countries are still in a circular economy of poverty and scarcity. And so I think one of the big problems is that the top-down approach doesn't work. And of course, the bottom-up approach is the local, producing local skilled labor and all this too, is much more difficult, and more difficult for authorities. For example, I have one thing for industrialized countries, that in any urban planning, every district must have craftsmen, a zone for craftsmen, repairmen, remanufacturing, because if your repair chap has to come, like the John Deere tractor in Scotland, if the repairman has to come one day and then return one day, simply repairs cannot be afforded. So the repair people for fridges and plumbers and all these things, they have to be in each district. They have to find an affordable place where they can have their workshop. So this, I think, yeah, if you ask me one thing in industrialized countries, that would be that in the circular economy has to be integrated into urban planning.
Yes, and making sure everything is decentralized.
Has to be, yes, decentralized, and of course, don't tax labor. That's on the policy, but that's again mostly in the north, tax non-renewable resource. But they don't tax labor.
Yes, thank you. And that chimes with
because then all the caring activities, not only circular economy of physical goods, but also looking after natural assets or cultural assets, human assets, teaching, all this becomes cheaper and more interesting for young people to enter if they can make a better living financially than today.
Yes, thank you. And that chimes with what Ken Webster said a number of episodes ago about the need to shift away from taxing labour and instead tax the use of virgin resources. So hopefully we start to get policymakers' ears pricking up and and thinking differently about what they could do. And Walter, before we tell people how they can connect with you and find out more, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
I think the important thing is stay optimist, because at the moment our world is a very destructive place. We have about 12 major wars going on worldwide, and they are completely destructive with regard to the circular economy. It's the opposite of a circular economy. So despite that, you have to stay optimist and try to do in the small place around you support initiatives. And recently I coined a term that was picked up, real men, real businessmen wear secondhand suits.
I like it.
And there are some companies now in Europe that ask if they repair something textile, they ask the customer if he wants it visibly repaired or not. Because if you can show you are visibly wearing something repaired, that gives you some kind of upgrade socially. And this is the kind of mental change we have to make. So there are a lot of things, but it's very cultural and therefore depends on each region and each community.
Yes, thank you. And I like that change of status towards pre-used and mended and second-hand. And yeah, hopefully that's the direction that we start to go in, more rapidly. So, lastly, how can people find out more and get in touch, Walter?
Well, my website, www.productlife.org, is really an archive. It's all the past publications and all this, but it's no longer actively managed. So if you want to follow my recent ideas at LinkedIn, that's the only social media I'm on, publications or LinkedIn, where I try to post as many ideas as I can, but I sometimes run out of time, but I do not run out of ideas, so.
Yes, I see you posting lots of things and wonder how you managed to cover so many aspects of the circular economy. But yes, so I think LinkedIn's a great place to follow what you're doing. So Walter, thanks so much for taking the time to share your views and insights with us. And I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for the enormous impact that you've made over the many years you've been doing this in shaping our thinking and helping us get clear on what the circular economy really is, in calling out misguided and false solutions, which I see you do regularly on LinkedIn, and getting the circular economy on the agenda for businesses and policymakers. So, Professor Walter Stahl, thank you very much.
Thank you, Catherine, for giving me the opportunity to present my ideas, talking to you. Thank you.
It was great to see you again. Thank you, Walter.
Thank you.
That was such an honour, and I'm incredibly grateful to Professor Walter Stahl for sharing his time and a few of his insights with us. I was interested to hear Walter's examples of companies moving away from mining or materials to gain competitive advantage over their rivals. This reminded me about Walter's concept of the era of D from his latest book. The era of D means developing ways to separate materials that have been transformed, for example, to de-alloy metals, to de-vulcanize, depolymerize, delaminate, deconstruct, and so on. And later we talked about remanufacturing, which is one of the elements in Walter's Era of R concept from the same book. The Era of R includes reuse, repair, to remarket things, re-refine, reprogram, refurbish, and remanufacture. Walter sees early signs of countries taking interest in recovering more value from their national assets, such as minerals. He's also noticing businesses shifting towards providing services instead of selling products. Walter explained how digital solutions can support these service-based models, in particular helping companies to assess and guarantee the durability and safety of their products. However, in some areas, Walter believes technology has gone too far in providing nice-to-have functionality. That means it's now too difficult to look after the equipment without expensive specialist support. Walter highlighted the risk of companies and countries going all in to invest in one solution, and then when something better comes along, being handicapped by stranded assets or suboptimal solutions. As we talked about the regular occurrence of major supply chain disruptions, even though these have different root causes, Walter sees this pattern leading to some relocalizing, which in the end will reduce globalization. If you don't already follow Walter on LinkedIn, please do look him up. He posts regularly, highlighting missed opportunities and misconceptions about circularity and the performance economy. So, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Circular Economy Podcast. And thank you to our awesome guest this week, Professor Walter Stahl. As always, I've included Walter's social media and other links, plus links to the people, articles, and books we mentioned in the show notes at circulareconomypodcast.com. The Circular Economy Podcast is brought to you by Rethink Global, the company I started to help you succeed with circular. You can find information on my talks, workshops and advice, plus circular economy resources at rethinkglobal.info. And you can connect with me, Catherine Wheatman, on LinkedIn. I believe we can all help make the circular economy happen through the choices we make at work and in our everyday lives. Buying pre-used, keeping what we have for longer, repairing it and making sure it has another life. Those choices send strong signals to companies and governments, making it clear we all want a better, circular and regenerative future. We can do better with less. We can all help spread the word too. Talk about the circular economy and help other people find this podcast by leaving us a rating and a review on your podcast app. If you're just starting out with the circular economy, why not check out our Getting Started playlist on the podcast homepage? You could also buy my award-winning book, A Circular Economy Handbook, How to Build a More Resilient, Competitive and Sustainable Business. It takes you through the concepts and practicalities with hundreds of real examples from all around the world. We've made it easier for you to find episodes on the key circular economy strategies, or for a market sector, or specific countries. Check out the Interactive Podcast Index. There's a link on the podcast homepage at circulareconomypodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening to the end, and if you like what you're hearing, please hit subscribe. And I'll see you next time.